Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today we take a look at your pet's health to begin the show, and Dr. Bill Stork back with us. He is the owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, also an author of several books, and it's great to have him back. Well, hear Dr. Stork's advice on what to do if your dog gets sick, and as we talk with him, want to hear from you, of course. Let us know how you care for your dog when it gets sick, for example. Or maybe you want to know how to tell if your dog is just feeling under the weather. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Dr. Bill Stork, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, good morning, Larry. Glad to be here. And it sounds as if you might need a neti pot yourself.
I don't think I have a cold, but I have a little congestion this morning for some reason. I don't know why. Would I give that to a dog, by the way, if I had a cold?
No, probably not. But the same set of circumstances, you know, time of year, lots of people, lots of pets. In smaller spaces, sharing air spaces, make it more likely for those things to be passed around.
Yeah. What are the most common infections that you're seeing at the clinic this time of year?
It's pretty repeatable and somewhat predictable. After the holidays, you can pretty much sit back, wait for a couple of days, and the phone will start to ring, especially with owners of dogs with kennel cough. And if we were on TV, I would make air quotes of kennel cough, because actually it's more a group of infectious respiratory diseases. The nerds would call it canine infectious respiratory disease complex. And it's not as if these dogs are going to kennels and going to groomers and being boarded and being exposed to any sort of novel organisms, because these are the organisms that are in the environment all the time. But some combination of the stress of being away, maybe an extra exposure to a dog that's clinical at the time, and the next thing you know, you have a dog that's coughing, runny eyes, runny nose, maybe even feeling a little bit lethargic. So kennel cough is easily the most common thing that we find this time of year.
Yeah. So if your dog is feeling lethargic, if it's sneezing, I mean, how do you know if it's something you ought to come and see you about or a vet?
Well, that's a perfect opportunity for a rewind. And I'll answer that question by first of all saying that I really don't want people to be nervous about kenneling their dog, about taking their dog to canine sports zones or to classes or any opportunity to socialize them, because the ramifications of not keeping your dog active and not keeping your dog socialized are much greater than any possible infection that they might acquire out there. And when that phone rings, you know, my dog is coughing, and actually the phone rang and there was a message in on my computer right before the show started. If that dog is still bright, alert, and responsive, BAR, eating and drinking and coughing infrequently, that's the dog that we would really prefer not to medicate. If the cough is at the point where the dog is having a hard time sleeping, or as a result of the dog coughing, the people are having a hard time sleeping, you know, we don't want the kids falling asleep in second grade because the dog's coughing all night, then that's a great opportunity to potentially use some cough medication, but not necessarily antibiotics. If the cough is persistent, if the dog is lethargic, you know, not responding to its normal cues with the vigor that it normally does, maybe the appetite is a little bit decreased, maybe a little bit less active on walks, and then is when we reach for the antibiotics. And just like people, one of the reasons why we don't like to reach for antibiotics is because these are always a mixed group of organisms that infects these dogs, and there's always viruses, there's always bacteria, and we prefer to get through it without antibiotics if we can.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. What about over-the-counter medications? You're worried about a cough or something?
Well, in the wake of Thanksgiving, we ran the Lake Mills Walgreens out of Robitussin DM. DM for dog medicine. You might think it's dextromethorphan, but it's actually DM for dog medicine. And that's the one that doesn't have any of the acetaminophen and everything else. And if you are in a setting, and there's plenty of settings where you can't speak with a veterinarian after hours, if you're up north, that's a really good tool to have around. And the dosage, you know, for a dog is the dosage for a kid. And you can use Robitussin DM up to every 4 to 6 hours to settle that cough down. And we're not trying to make the dog not cough, because a cough is this beautiful piece of physiology that helps us expel infectious organisms. But if it is obstructive, that's when we need to mute it as best we can.
Yeah. Let's turn to sneezes for a minute. Casey emailed us, as an indoor cat about 10 years old, been sneezing a lot lately, a bunch of sneezes, maybe 4 to 8 per time. Plus, he's sleeping more than these past few days, and his ears were feeling cool to the touch. He probably got a cold last week, and how cold it's been. Do you think this is a reasonable deductive thought? Any advice on how to keep him, how to heal him or make him feel better at least?
Well, it's a good deductive thought, so long as we realize a cold is a big broad description of a group of symptoms that could be caused by a whole lot of different things. And when Casey's cat is sneezing, then the things that we ask are, what is the nature of the sneeze? What is the expectorant look like? And when people say, well, they don't produce anything, that means that it's clear. And like, if he can take his glasses and put in front of the cat when it sneezes, that would allow him to be able to tell if there's any off color to what the cat is sneezing. If it is off color, just like in kids or people, that's indicative of an infection. Other things to be looking at with regard to a 10-year-old cat that started to sneeze more frequently is their resting respiratory rate, when they are doing nothing. And we would prefer that resting respiratory rate to be well below or in the vicinity of 30 or fewer respirations per minute. Appetite, he mentioned that the cat was being a little bit lethargic as well. So when a 10-year-old cat develops a sneeze and is a little bit lethargic, and I'll even make an assumption that the cat's largely inside, that gets our attention. And if that is to persist for any period of time, that could warrant a veterinary visit.
Yeah, makes sense. Vivian in Green Bay has a question. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. Hello. I've had cats for 7 decades, 25 or so. Years ago, dentals were uncommon. And now I consider them necessary, and I have 3 cats. But I had heard that dentals contribute to deafness, and I wonder if there's any information about that.
Dentals contribute to deafness. Boy, that just should not be the case if they are done cautiously and carefully, because as you have noticed, profound dental disease can lead to a whole host of problems, ranging from heart murmurs to tooth root abscesses to sinus infections. As you have noticed, we have indeed, we as in the veterinary community and pet owners, have started to focus more on ongoing dental health. And what we really love to do is get ahead of it like any other health condition. And the healthier and stronger the patient that we do that dental, extract those diseased and abscessed teeth, the longer that and stronger that cat will live.
Vivian, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Chase in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Chase.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I have a husky who is about 5.5 years old, and for the last quarter of a year, he's been dealing with pretty low appetite and kind of endless diarrhea. At first, they suspected it might have been Addison's disease, but he fell outside of the range for those markers. And so now it's looking likely that it could be some GI tract lymphoma. They prescribed an antibiotic for diarrhea. I guess my question is, and they recently took him off it, what sort of treatments would be advised for that, and why would they prescribe an antibiotic if he's not dealing with any bacterial infection in his GI tract, especially when the side effects can worsen the diarrhea?
Well, the reason is, and obviously I'm going to have to make a little bit of extrapolation and be cautious here, because if they have tested your 5.5-year-old husky for Addison's, that means that they've done a CBC and they've done a chemistry panel, and there are some indications in there that will lead us to do the testing for Addison's disease. And what they're doing is they're marching through the differential diagnoses for a dog with diarrhea. The reason why they use the antibiotics, the metronidazole, I would bet, is one of the most common causes for dogs to have diarrhea is, this is a great opportunity to use a great veterinary term, intestinal dysbiosis. It used to be called SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, but essentially the GI flora are out of whack. And the reason why your veterinarian put him on metronidazole is because often they get better on metronidazole. And we don't often exactly know why, but we as veterinarians are always weighing risks versus benefit. And very, very frequently, empirical treatment with metronidazole in these dogs get better. In addition to the absolute diagnostics for intestinal lymphosarcoma, we can oftentimes suspect intestinal lymphosarcoma when we've ruled everything else out and when the dog has not responded to all reasonable treatment. The absolute diagnosis of intestinal lymphosarcoma is to go in and do surgery and take biopsies from several different places along the gastrointestinal tract. And that's a pretty heavy-handed, invasive diagnostic. And most of us will try and not go quite to that extent.
Yeah, yeah. There you go, Chase. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Just to mention, after 12:30 today, we'll talk about caring for rabbits, hedgehogs, and ferrets with a vet from Cambridge, Wisconsin, who takes a special interest in exotic mammals and birds. Right now, talking mostly dogs and cats here with Dr. Bill Stork. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Dr. Bill, if you have multiple dogs and one of them gets sick with a cold, let's say, how is there any way to prevent the other pets from getting the cold too?
You know, brace for impact. If your fifth grader comes home with a cold and a cough, then there's a really good chance that it's going to go through the household, but oftentimes someone will be spared. You know, it's the way we build our immune system. So it's likely going to happen short of shower in, shower out, and complete separation of the dogs, which is often not practical.
Certainly not. You know, I get a cold that might last sometimes 3 days, sometimes a week. I haven't had one for quite a while, actually. But is that about the same for a dog or a cat?
You know, most of the time, and you touched on about 3 hours worth of conversation that I'll try and compress to just a few minutes, but it's worthy of note that the enormous majority of the time when dogs get kennel cough, it will last for 5 days to 7 days. There are times when it'll last up to 2 weeks, and in rare occasions, it will last for, you know, it'll last for 3 to 4 weeks. That cough will linger. With regard to cats, and Larry's a cat guy, and lots of people are, when we are presented with a cat with a respiratory issue, I've developed a practice that I always warn the owner that there's a possibility that cat could be what we call a chronic snorkeler. And a chronic snorkeler is a highly medical term which describes a cat with a chronic respiratory issue that, I mean, you can go to the University of Wisconsin, money's no issue, break the bank, do every conceivable test, every conceivable treatment, and the cat coughs and blows snot for its entire life.
Oh, my gosh. Well, by the way, somebody wondered how dangerous kennel cough is.
Well, kennel cough, and we're going to circle back and use the medical term canine infectious respiratory disease complex, in a young, healthy, immunocompetent dog, it's really not anything to be afraid of or alter your life for. I would not change anything about what I do with my dog because of kennel cough. Most of them recover very quickly. There are situations where kennel cough becomes something like canine influenza, which still shouldn't be too bad of a problem unless you have a dog that is immunocompromised, a dog that is aged, a dog that's on a poor plane of nutrition. So the enormous majority of the time, those dogs climb out of it and do just fine.
We have callers online with questions. Sidra in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just have a question about hairballs with cats. I have a cat that, you know, coughs them up a decent amount, and I was wondering if you have any recommendations for him.
Oh, sure. Lots of different approaches to that. There's food out there that will bill itself as hairball remedy, and it will have some sort of a lubricant and a laxative in there that can genuinely be of help. According to Dr. Google, pumpkin is effective with any malady that could affect your dog or cat's gastrointestinal tract. But this is actually a thing that pumpkin, if your cat likes it, can be effective, because pumpkin is fiber, pumpkin is a laxative, pumpkin can help escort things through there. Over the counter, there's things like laxatone, and that is physically like an oily laxative lubricant that will help move things through. One of the other common sense approaches that can make a very big difference is keeping your cats brushed out and groomed. So if you brush out the substrate that they build the hairballs on, you'll cut down on the frequency of the hairballs. There are also treats that can be very effective. So the key is to avoid what is human nature. And that is, well, my cat got better, so I stopped doing the treatment. So if it is getting better and you're giving the treats, the food, the laxative, the pumpkin, keep doing it, and the cat will probably hack up fewer hairballs, but they're obligated to hack up a few on occasion.
Okay. Sidra, thank you for calling. Tricia in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there. I have a, I guess he's about 13-year-old cat who was diagnosed with diabetes about a year ago. And then he went into remission a couple months later. And then, you know, then ended up being diagnosed again with diabetes. And we did some serious dietary changes as well as insulin. And now it's, so now it's been about a year that he's been in remission. And I think my overall question is just based on your experience, how, you know, I don't want to be too optimistic, but I'm just sort of curious, how long can a cat stay in remission?
In my experience, diabetic cats have turned out any conceivable way possible. And there are, I think the statistics are somewhere in the vicinity of 13 to 15% of diabetic cats will go into remission. And just as you have discovered, they can dance in and out of remission. Diabetes is a really complicated metabolic disease. And especially if you are treating a low carbohydrate diet, they very well may stay in remission for a good long time. You have reason to be hopeful, but if you're in doubt, then, you know, a very reasonable approach is to ask your veterinarian to show you how to measure your cat's blood glucose at home and when to measure your cat's blood glucose at home, because, you know, if in doubt, put some numbers on it. And, you know, we can usually tell when they're diabetic because they drink more water and they make more frequent visits to the litter box. And you can tell by the much larger urinary output, but not always. And if you have multiple cats in the household, that gets more difficult to check, but it's not difficult to measure blood glucose at home.
All right. Tricia, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Canine para influenza is different from dog flu. I think I understand it that way.
It is, and it's one of the viruses that is also in the quote-unquote distemper vaccine that dogs get. And it's also one of the viruses, when we talk about canine infectious disease or canine infectious respiratory disease complex, in that complex, parainfluenza virus is one of those viruses.
Okay, and so those shots, do they eliminate the problem or?
Well, just like any other vaccine, in a perfect world, we would prevent them from ever getting sick as a result of that virus. In the real world, what we find is many fewer of them get sick as a result of that virus. And when they do, the symptoms have a tendency to be dramatically less.
All right.
And yes, it parainfluenza virus is different than canine influenza. And while we're talking canine influenza, that one is what we call a lifestyle-based vaccine. It's not part of what most of us use in our core vaccines. And the dogs that we think about giving the canine influenza virus to are ones that are going to go to dog shows, to rally classes, that are going to be going to, strangely enough, the Fox Valley area up until the Appleton and Green Bay area, Chicago, Milwaukee, even Madison. If they're going to be going to daycare frequently, then that those are the dogs that we think about giving the canine influenza vaccine to.
Oh, that's where the chances are higher.
Yep, absolutely. Much greater exposure.
Okay. Jim in Nasita has a question for you. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. I just have a question. I have a 7-year-old lab shepherd mix, really good dog, very healthy. goes to the vet on a regular basis. And I noticed just right around the beginning of December, he was starting to, he just started getting a small lump about almond size, maybe a little bit larger on the, on his left side, or I like to say his driver's side. And it's not stationary, it's movable. And I've been hearing a lot of stuff from other people, and of course, you know, the internet about mushrooms or some sort of supplements or something that can go to his food that would help alleviate these. Or is it something I need to be concerned with?
Well, it's something that you need to be aware of. And 7 years old is old enough that we have to pay attention to lumps. And you made a lot of really valuable observations with regard to that lump, that you can get your fingers around it and it's freely movable and it's smooth. And he's a lab shepherd mix. There's an excellent possibility that that is a good old fashioned lipoma, which is an obligatory rite of passage for dogs as they age. And it's a bit of a reach to think that any of these supplements might reduce those, but open mind, I certainly can't imagine that they would do any harm. But about 10% of the time, we will find lumps that seem benign, that seem like a good old-fashioned lipoma, that turn out to be something like a mast cell tumor. And a mast cell tumor is on the list of things that we find with enough frequency to make it worth sticking a needle in that thing, pulling out some cells, putting them on a slide and just confirming that it is as benign as we suspect it is.
Yeah. So worth getting to the vet maybe and having that done.
Jim, not an emergency, but well worth your time.
Yeah. Okay. Jim, good luck. Thank you for calling. Denisha in Madison, your turn. Hi, Denisha.
Yeah, hello. I have a question. I have 15-year-old cat who is very healthy. He's red color, long hair. He's running up to trees and listening and a very good cat. But he never want to eat something like canned food or our food, only dry food all his life. And because he is a little bit more dry, then I think that it has to be. Is this cat missing something? Because he's 15. But he, I can say he's never changing his health. He never had problem. It means this is my question. 15 years old.
What do you feed him, by the way?
Science diet.
Okay. Yeah, a good diet. And I will tell you that I think that's a really good sign that he's persistent about eating his dry food. And let the record show that changing the trajectory of a cat is not the easiest thing in the world to do. And it's not unusual for cats that have spent their entire life eating kibble that when you present them with canned food or tuna or moist foods that we think should be enticing to them, that we think should get them more moisture in their diet, and they just turn up their nose and walk the other direction. So it hopefully that means that his teeth are also in pretty good shape. It sounds like his mobility is excellent, and that is fantastic. Yeah. So, you know, there's 100 old metaphors out there about not being able to lead a horse. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, and you can give a cat canned food, but you can't make him eat it.
I've learned that, believe me, with my two cats. Denisha, there you go. Sounds like you're in pretty good shape. Tara in Colfax, Illinois, we'll go to you. Hi, Tara.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I have an 11-year-old Labradoriner dog that has been coughing for about 2 years. The vet thinks she has a collapsed trachea. She's been on antibiotics and cough medicine, and it doesn't work. Is there anything that can be done? Are there any cures for a collapsed trachea?
Couple questions. First of all, how big is your 11-year-old dog?
She's a Labradoriner. She's about 95 pounds.
Big dude. Okay. Yeah. And under what circumstances does this cough take place? Is it when we're particularly active or when we're particularly...
Not at all. It middle of the night, random. In fact, even when we go, she is active. We walk daily. It's quite frequently, and it almost sounds like she's choking and going to throw up, but she never throws up. It's not really like a cough. I guess it's more like like she's going to throw up, but she never does.
Okay. And I assume radiographs have been taken?
No, they haven't actually.
Okay.
No.
That would be the first next step is, you know, if in doubt, we start doing some diagnostics and asking some questions and see if we can't get some answers that way.
Yeah.
X-rays would be the next step.
All right. There you go, Tara. Thank you. Pam and Marshall, it's your turn. Hi, Pam.
Hi. My son adopted a dog 3 years ago. He rescued her, and she was 3 months old. And she still starts shaking anytime she hears a noise, like even coffee grinder, dryer, washer, anything like that. And he's very gentle with her and is very patient. But do you think this would ever go away, or is it possible this may last her whole life?
Well, he's got himself a wee bit of a challenge there for certain, and it sounds as if your son is taking a very common sense approach, but there's a lot of intricacies in there that would be hard to work our way through without actually watching these things happen, because there's a possibility that when this happens, your son is actually reinforcing the cat being, or the dog being nervous. For example, when the coffee grinder goes off and the dog trembles, if your son goes to the dog, then he could be rewarding that behavior. And believe me, that's not any sort of a criticism with regard to your son. The short answer is the way to work with those situations is by way of counter conditioning. And the premise of counter conditioning is to keep the dog outside or into its comfort zone, but on the edge of its comfort zone. So, and just painting with a broad brush here, for example, if it is indeed the coffee grinder, then find how far away from that coffee grinder the dog needs to be in order to not get nervous or not get terribly nervous. And then have a second person push the button on the coffee grinder and reward the dog, and that exercise is over. And you can see these things take a lot of reps and a lot of persistence and a whole big bunch of patience. And hopefully the coffee grinder translates to the doorbell, translates to, you know, the car starting or other triggers that make the dog nervous. But it's tough. Get yourself a certified behaviorist who very well may be able to help with that.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Pam, thank you very much for calling. You can turn in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Listener called, couldn't stay with us, but wondered if you could talk more about congestive heart failure in dogs. The symptoms, diagnosis, treatments, if any?
Well, that would actually be exactly why I recommended that Tara down in Colfax, Illinois, takes her dog to get x-rays, because congestive heart failure is a pretty common finding in aging dogs. There's actually groups of breeds where it's a little bit more predominant. Like your King Charles Cavalier Spaniels, it's fairly common. Cocker Spaniels, it's fairly common. And the symptoms that you will recognize could be a slightly rapid resting respiratory rate, exercise intolerance, or the big one is a cough that takes place more when the dog is at rest. Because when we're at rest, We don't respirate, we don't ventilate, we don't circulate nearly as well as we do when we are up and we are active. And that can, the congestive heart failure is the extension of a heart murmur. A heart murmur is an abnormal heart sound in between the heart beats, and it is as a result of blood leaking backwards in the heart and eventually pooling in the lungs, and we get fluid in the lungs is kind of the short answer, and that's what leads to the cough associated with congestive heart failure, congestive heart disease. The good news is it's also a condition that we can usually pretty successfully manage.
Excellent. All right. Judy in Waukegan, Illinois emailed, Judy had a beagle who developed kennel cough as soon as they brought him home from the breeder, the real viral kind, which developed within 2 weeks into high fever and double pneumonia. He's the only dog Jody's ever known who had to be kept in an oxygen tent for 3 days and monitored 24/7. So Jody just wanted to toss in that to folks, if your dog doesn't improve, you ought to get him to a doctor.
No, absolutely. And those are the cases that are out there in the periphery. We don't see those very often, but clearly they're on the list of things that can happen.
Shannon in Wisconsin Rapids, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I'm calling because we have a Rottweiler Mastiff mix who has very floppy ears, and she seems to be very prone to ear infections. We've seen a vet for treatment when this gets pretty bad, but I was wondering if there's any advice on how to be a little more preemptive with keeping these ear infections at bay.
Yeah, we develop, you know, obviously that's individual to the patient, and the answers are very frequent cleaning, and we search for the frequency required to prevent the infection from setting in. And that's going to be different for every single solitary dog. The worst ear infection that I ever saw, the most persistent ear infection that I ever saw, actually belonged to a German Shepherd named Mike that belonged to a Vietnam veteran also named Mike. And that dog had the most erect, largest ears that I've ever seen on a dog. But that dog did not read the book about floppy ears and had an ear infection very, very persistently. That dog, we had to clean its ears 2-3 times a week. Sometimes even when repeated cleanings aren't enough to keep things at bay, then we'll resort to what we call pulse therapy. And what pulse therapy is we'll pick, for example, 10 days at the beginning of every month or 10 days at the beginning every couple of months and treat it to keep things at bay. That's not our favorite way of doing business. There are also times, and it's worthy of pointing out that sometimes ears are ears, and sometimes ears are an extension of the skin, because the skin is the biggest organ in the body. And if the dog also has skin issues, they can extend into the ears as well. So lots of nuance there. And if it's a deeper ear infection, sometimes, not often, but sometimes we will put those dogs under general anesthesia and get all the way to the eardrum to clean those ears out. With it, when it's really, really persistent, sometimes general anesthesia and exam and deep cleaning can be the ticket.
Shannon, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. What's the, is the solution that you use the same for any dog, Dr. Bill?
We always want to not be irritating. You know, when people say, yeah, I use dilute hydrogen peroxide, we beg them not to. Oftentimes, we want people to use things that are mild, things that are not oily. Please no essential oils or anything to that effect. And things that have an astringent property to them, like propylene glycol, that will help dry the ears out lots of them will have ingredients in there that will break up the wax and the crud in the bottom of the ears. Some of them will have like ketoconazole in them, which is an antifungal, because, you know, people ask, you know, why does my dog keep having ear infections? My response is, why don't they? I can't imagine a more perfect place to grow things than an ear. Yeah. It's warm, it's moist, it's a dead end. There's sloughing cells, there's blood, there's all kinds of substrate to grow things. So not uncommon.
Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we hear the story of four women physicists who escaped Nazi Germany during World War II. We'll also take a look at a new travel guide. That's tomorrow on the show. Right now, looking at your pet's health with Dr. Bill Stork of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. And lots of callers online. It was one question, just back to colds again. Somebody's wondering, can you catch a cold that your dog has or the other way around?
Probably not.
Okay, there we go. Ginny and Madison, your turn. Thank you for calling, Ginny.
I have a 13-year-old, approximately. She's a rescue Beagle Basset mix. She has a heart murmur, but it's not giving her any problems. As a matter of fact, the last time she was due for either an echo or a x-rays, she was doing so well that the vet didn't even recommend that she have either or. We did start her on 5 milligrams of pimobentin. She's happy. She's energetic. She walks every day. She eats. Her reps every morning before we get out of bed are 12, 13, in that range, never much over 13 or 14. My question is, I take her once every 5 or 6 weeks to be bathed at a facility that is a dog care. They have dogs come in and spend the day there. And apparently they had some dog that had a kennel cough. My dog has been vaccinated for kennel cough. And I take her early in the morning so that she is not with any other dogs. She's not kenneled. They bathe her, and then I wait for her and take her home. Is it okay to continue to take her there if there's kennel cough?
Yeah, I think the risk is fairly minimal, not because of the risk of exposure is minimal, but because you're doing so many things so well. And first of all, a 13-year-old approximately Beagle Basset with a heart murmur that you are walking every day and preemptively giving the pimobendin, then you have your bases covered, and that is absolutely positively awesome. And speaking for myself, I wouldn't hesitate to deprive my dog the spa day just because of the heart murmur and the potential exposure to kennel cough.
Yeah, that makes sense. Ginny, thank you for calling. Gerard and Marshall, your turn. Hi, Gerard.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Hey, we have a bunch of Great Danes. We have 4 adults and 4 puppies, and we had 5. I'm calling you about Duke. He was 5 years and 3 months old, and he seemed fine. The only issue he had was he had a hot spot that he kept licking and licking and licking for 3 years. But one day we walked out into the kennel, and he was laying there dead. And he had blood coming out of his nose, and our vet said that he probably had a heart attack. Does that sound about right?
Well, kind of like kennel cough and kind of like a cold, a heart attack is a big, wide, overarching description of a whole group of potential etiologies. And in a person, when we talk about them having a heart attack, usually what that means is that one of our greater coronary arteries has been obstructed and deprived the heart of blood flow. Not likely that. In a 5-year-old Great Dane that died acutely and had blood coming out of its nostrils, a really common finding in those dogs that could also fall under the category of a heart attack is a heart tumor. Dogs are famous for cardiac hemangiosarcomas, big vascular tumors that can grow on the heart. And those dogs can be absolutely 100% normal right up until they pass suddenly. And when they pass suddenly, it is because that really vascular tumor has bled out. And that's just one of the things on the list of possibilities that could have resulted in the untimely and sad demise of your dog. But yeah, that hopefully that fleshes it out just a little bit.
Yeah. Gerard, thank you for calling. Sorry that you lost your dog. Shane in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Shane.
Hey, I have a three-year-old black lab that from the beginning, he's always had like digestive issues. He has pudding poop. We've tried Pro One, Purina. We've tried Jinx. And recently with trying the Jinx dog food, he is with pumpkin in it, he's now starting to eat his own poop. It has horrible gas, and it doesn't matter what food we seem to try to, it doesn't seem to take care of the poop issue or now the new issue.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's always one of our favorite conversations in veterinary medicine. My dog is eating his own poop. But ahead of all of that is a lot of really frustrating time with those loose stools. I assume that your three-year-old lab is otherwise physically really strong, good body condition, good endurance. Everything else about the dog is in good shape. Is that correct?
Oh yeah. He's great. He's, you know, he's almost 90 pounds, shiny coat, you know, just great shape.
Okay. And I also assume that your veterinarian, there's a whole litany of tests that we do, CBC chemistry panel. Those usually turn out to be normal. And then there's a test out there called a GI panel that your dog would have had to been fasted for 12 hours before they drew the blood. Was that test done by any chance?
No, we just had them at a checkup, and they never said to do that or asked to do that. They took a stool sample for like parasites and stuff like that. They said that was all normal, but nothing fasting.
Okay. Well, this is one of those cases where it's a lot easier to be on the radio, on the telephone, than it is the vet that's in the trenches trying to solve these problems, because these issues can be elusive and they can be challenging. And whatever you do, don't tell your vet that, hey, that guy on the radio said, why aren't you doing a GI panel, or why aren't you doing a fecal PCR? But the guy on the radio says there is a more detailed, more sensitive fecal test that is a referral test that costs quite a bit of extra money, but in these persistent cases can give us some answers. And when you're talking about, per chance, are these stools like an obnoxiously large volume stools like cow flop feces?
No, he'll start out solid, you know, and have like, you know, three solid ones, and then it goes to the loose stool afterwards.
Sure. Yeah. And that's probably why your veterinarian has not gone to the extent of doing any of these more detailed tests. But it really sounds like you're heading in the right direction. Just keep asking questions.
Yeah. Well, there you go, Shane. Thank you so much. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest, he'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking your pet's health with Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. He works with both small and large animals. And great to have him back to answer questions about your pet's health. Join in. You can email us to talk@WPR.org or give a call to 800-642-1234. Perry in Oconto has a question for you, Dr. Bill. Let's go there. Hi, Perry.
Hello, and thank you, Dr. Bill, for the service you provide to us. So thank you very much. I have a two-part question. One is first on HeartGuard and the preventative for that. I was saw an article that was saying things about ophthalmologists in the veterinary world had some concerns about low-dose ivermectin, and Interceptor Plus did not use that type of drug to treat the heartworm. And so my question was, do you use Interceptor Plus, or have you heard of anything about the retinal damage that can be done by ivermectin? And the second question is, now this doesn't concern me too much, but I saw that Credelio had a very good efficacy on the Lone Star tick, which doesn't concern me, but I was wondering if the efficacy was tested on the deer tick, and I've currently used NexGard, but that was terrible on the Lone Star tick.
Well, first of all, Terry, you've given me a homework assignment because I will have to go out on our database and search for those studies that suggest that low-dose ivermectin could potentially cause retinal damage, because if that's the case, I'm not aware of it, but we absolutely use Interceptor as well. We'll use Interceptor on lots of our shepherd type dogs or anybody that might have that MDR1 mutation, in which case my answer is that if you have any sort of hesitation and there is an equally effective option, then we use the equally effective option. And the answer with regard to the Credelio is, yeah, it's just good. Credelio is really quick to kill the Lone Star tick. And, you know, the Texans are making their way north, ticks and all. And we've actually seen the Lone Star tick as far north and as far east as New Hampshire and Connecticut. And we don't think that the Lone Star tick is capable of transmitting Lyme disease, but there's a really reliable statistic out there that 25% of our ticks are Lyme positive, because in the environment, half of our ticks are deer ticks and half of those deer ticks are Lyme positive. And for those who are resting comfortably looking at the calendar that it's January, it's going to be in the 40s this week, if not in the 50s, and ticks will be active this week. So, yeah, Credelio is a wonderful option.
And Kimberly in DeForest had asked if it was necessary to give her dog NexGard the year round.
It's best, because for a couple of reasons, one of which is we have a chart on the wall in our exam room, and I think that last winter there were something like 25 days when it was too cold for ticks to be active. Last winter, we started picking off live ticks the first weekend in February. Yeah. Not to mention the fact that some of the worst, most heinous flea infestations that we find are in the dead of winter, if you can call this a winter.
Yeah. Doug in Waniwak, we'll go to you. Hi, Doug.
How you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call.
And I talked to you earlier with another veterinarian about my dog who had a really bad phlegmy cough, and it was around the time of the Canadian wildfires. He goes to two vets, and I take him regularly. One vet has an x-ray machine, the other one doesn't. Anyways, they both recommended Benadryl, which helps him a lot. Originally, he was put on amoxicillin, and then they dosed it down to doxycycline. But he still coughs from time to time, every time he comes from cold to warm. And I was wondering, maybe a third opinion might be needed.
Well, I have a third opinion, or maybe it's more of a question than an opinion. How old is your dog, and approximately what breed is your dog?
He's a rough collie. The x-ray showed he had a growth by his esophagus, but he goes in there regularly to get x-rayed, and it hasn't grown. And he's roughly 10 years old.
Yeah, there's a real possibility that growth next to his esophagus is contributing to that cough. And personally, I have diagnosed those growths next to the esophagus, those growths in the thorax in general, and foolishly issued the owner a gloom and doom prognosis, only for the dog to do great, maybe with a little bit of a cough, maybe with a little bit of exercise intolerance. But those dogs carry on and do well for a good long time. I seriously doubt if more antibiotics are going to be effective. If something so simple as an antihistamine helps fend off the symptoms, then that is fantastic. And another reason, just to flesh some things out here, I completely and totally understand that as a client, as a pet owner, we really want the answer. The challenge is that in order to get the answer, there are certain parts of medicine that the answer is really, really elusive, because in a dog like this, the next level of diagnostic could be a procedure called a bronchoalveolar lavage. And what we do with bronchoalveolar lavage is that we anesthetize those dogs, pass an endotracheal tube, flush several cc's of water into their lungs, recover that water, and submit it for cytology and culture and et cetera, et cetera. That's a pretty heavy-handed piece of diagnostic that doesn't always lead to a strict cure. So, man, if that dog is living a good life, energetic and active, and a little bit of Benadryl makes them feel better, that might be an excellent option.
Doug, there you go. Thank you for calling. Olivia in Madison, your turn. Hi, Olivia.
Hi. So it's a small world. I've definitely actually contacted your animal behaviorist and might meet with her. But I have a general question. I have an older cat. I think she's about 13, and we do Solensia for her likely arthritis, and she plays a little bit, she's cuddly. I'm just kind of wondering, as cats age, what you recommend for enrichment and what you recommend for general care and what you recommend for how long they should actually be left alone, those sorts of things.
Well, cats, I think, to a very large extent, would prefer to be left alone. I mean, you give them food, water, litter, and the remote control, and they're happy for a very long period of time. But enrichment can very much vary according to that cat's physical capabilities. And the Solensia is a tool that has served us really, really well, and a tool that has contributed to older cats' quality of life like no other product we've seen in a good long time. And there has recently been some press with regard to the Solensia and its canine counterpart, Librela, with regard to some potential neurologic side effects. That's a great big conversation all by itself, but we've found precious few side effects and a lot of additional quality of life. So with regard to engagement, 101 ways to engage the cat, whether that be delivering their food, for example, in a treat ball, if they'll still bat a treat ball around, by hiding their food throughout the house, make it a hide and go seek operation to find their food. You know, if they'll still play with a string, the things that we caution people on, like laser pointers, I envision that to be kind of a younger man's game, a younger girl's game. But if you use a laser pointer, be limited, because with regard to the laser pointer, if they chase the red light, that's great, but they never catch anything. It's like going fishing with a naked hook and never getting a bite. Yeah, I love the fact that you're thinking about engaging your aged cat. They don't do crossword puzzles, but they can search for their food.
Yeah, search for their food. And I've got an aging cat who likes it's kind of a plate-sized thing, and it's covered, and there's a ball inside, and Tiger will go over and rap away on that ball and try and catch up to it and just enjoy it. And there's no batteries required or anything else. It's just the simplest toy is the one that he's used the most.
Yeah, and so often that is the case. And maybe it's a little anthropomorphic on my part, but we have a few people around Lake Mills who will put their cat in a stroller. And there are strollers out there that are cat carriers where the cats are secure. Man, if I was a cat cooped up in the house all the time and somebody wanted to take me for a stroll, I'd think that was the greatest thing ever. Other things that you can do, like catios, patios, and tunnels where they have exposure to the outside, and especially if you have a bird feeder outside. So, man, sometimes they really get fired up over watching the birds outside.
Yeah. Mine likes them on TV, too.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Is one of the cats, Tiger, can see the TV very well, particularly likes watching golf. I think because they often have a lot of bird songs.
And the soothing voices of the commentators, those guys are really good.
Yeah, Jim Nance is pretty good. Well, there you go, Olivia. Cheryl in Hillsboro, your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I've been concerned about my golden doodle male. He's 4 years old now, and he's been a real healthy guy all along. But a week ago, he jumped up from a sound sleep, and he looked confused and couldn't keep his balance. It seemed like it was more his right rear leg that was the issue. He was trying to walk and he just was staggering. It only lasted a couple minutes. He didn't seem like he was in pain. It just seemed more like he couldn't keep his balance. And then that same day, 2 hours later, the same thing happened. And 2 hours later from that, it happened. So it happened three times that day. It hasn't happened since. I got a little video of it and had sent it to my vet because they just asked for that. And he thought it was a mild seizure. But I also was reading online and read there was things with muscle spasms in dogs' hind legs that kind of sounded like it. And I also thought back how the last couple of months he has not wanted to jump up on the couch or up on my lap. He's been, he's 39 pounds, but he's my lap dog, you know. He jumps up there and likes to sit on my lap, you know, every day. He has not wanted to. He doesn't really want to go up steps, but he will. He acts like he's scared to go up now. And that happened prior to this episode. So it made me wonder if it's something more with joints or if it could be two separate issues. I was wondering what you would think, and I sure appreciate your help with it.
Well, Cheryl, first of all, what I think is you are really, really observant and really, really dialed in and getting some most excellent care, because sometimes we're lumpers and sometimes we're splitters. Sometimes we try and put things together into one condition, and sometimes they're actually two different conditions. So everything you did with regard to the neurologic episode is spot on. You monitored how long it lasted, how frequently it took place, how long it took your dog to recover. And I assume that you're keeping track of that, and also to take a video and send that to your veterinarian. In which case, it should be pretty easy to determine if this is a neurologic event, such as a seizure, because those dogs are oftentimes ataxic, falling to one side, confused, don't necessarily respond to normal stimuli. And a very crucial component of that is it's episodic, in which case there's an onset and then there's a resolution. And that really makes us, that's pretty unique to neurologic situations. And as god awful and as unsettling as that is, it's encouraging because it sounds like this is a version that, if needed, you should be able to manage it pretty well with medication. There's a real possibility when you talk about a four-year-old golden doodle hesitant to jump up on your lap or go up the stairs, that there's also some arthritis in his hips or in his back that could very well be worth some x-rays, some radiographs to get an idea of what's going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go, Sherry. Thank you very much for calling. And Catherine in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Catherine.
Hello, great guest, Larry. And I have a kitty that loved to watch the Olympics on TV. So there, two of them.
Good.
And I have an 18-year-old cat, and she's been on a science diet for urinary problems. And now she doesn't want to eat those pebbles. So I cut it and mix it with a pate, and many times she'll just eat the pate and leave the others, so I have to kind of work with it. Is there anything that I can do to get her to get him to eat?
Yeah, exactly. Well, first of all, exactly what you're doing, which is that at 18 years of age in these aging cats, much like aging dogs, I had a 15-year-old dog that we had to say goodbye to recently. And when they get to that point in life, supplementing their food is exactly what we do. I would also add in there that if he has not had a workup, if he hasn't had blood work recently, that could be worth doing just to make sure that there's not a medical underpinnings there. And one of the most common things we find is renal insufficiency. And oftentimes those cats can benefit with some simple subcutaneous fluids periodically. So if we rule out underlying medical issues, then, you know, what this cat wants to eat, this cat gets.
Catherine, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My previous dog was a massive stick chewer, which was fantastic, because I never hardly ever had to buy toys. And my current dog hates sticks and loves all the fluffy toys and other chew toys. And I recently stepped on a sharp piece of plastic, and which is not a first, and I'm sure it'll happen again, but it provoked a thought, which was, I've been feeding my dog plastics and microplastics for a decade now. And so basically my question is, obviously all these plushy toys that are nylon-based and polyester and nylon stuffing is terribly unhealthy for the dog and the environment. But beyond that, the nylabones and the dental bones that are partial plastic, I'm really concerned about having her chew on these plastic-based dental bones because of the microplastic. Now that I'm aware of how much plastic I've fed my dog for the past decade, I'm really overly worked up about this, and maybe you could share your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, I can sense your reservations and your hesitation, and I feel that people have a tendency to carry their concerns with their own health over to their pets. And when, if you are concerned about plastics and nylon and things like that, and your dog chewing on them, from a physiologic standpoint, from a scientific standpoint, they really should pass through. They really are pretty inert. They're not going to get absorbed, and they're likely to come out the other side very similar to how they went in. But Mike is concerned, in which case, why wouldn't we look for options that are considerably more natural? And we're always weighing risks versus benefits, because other things that they could chew on, bones are very common. And dogs have been chewing on bones as long as there have been dogs, and there's risks there. Sometimes they may fracture a tooth, but oftentimes the rest of the teeth are in really, really excellent shape. There are other options, things like bully sticks and raw hides, which can be controversial, but we're careful with raw hides, and we just don't recommend unsupervised rawhide chewing. But my answer, my short answer, would be bully sticks and bones.
There you go, Mike. Thank you so much for calling. And on that note, Dr. Bill, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's really been a pleasure. You always do such a great job. And I will, and our listeners will look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Bill.
Well, you bet. I'm just a little bit disappointed, Larry, because we had Oconto, Wanawak, and Wausau. I was waiting for Oconomowoc to call in as well, so we could get all the more of the funky Wisconsin towns.
We'll try for that next time around, Bill. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, works with both small and large animals, and he knows a whole lot. Great to have him with us. Coming up, we'll talk about taking care of rabbits and ferrets and hedgehogs. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.